For a movement to take hold, it can put to use one of two very different foundations. There are, of course, facts and truth, while the other is masking and, let's say, manipulating. In either case, if you can draw enough people, your movement will stand and it will grow. Christian nationalism is an example of a movement which has seen the growth that has brought the movement into all corners of our society, from the local school board to the White House in 2016, and maybe again. My next guest is an investigative journalist who has spent years doing far more than just reporting on this Christian nationalist movement. She's analyzed the mechanics, the methods, and the leaders, some of whom you'll know, others you really need to know more about. She's put her discoveries in her book, The Power of Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. Catherine Stewart, thanks so much for being here today, Catherine.
It's great to be in conversation with you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
CatherineStewart.me is Catherine's website. And yes, we do have a link at our homepage. I have spoken about this topic with different people on a more than frequent basis, as my show is usually not one to stay too long on one point because there's a lot out there. But this took priority for me for a variety of reasons. And I always want to start the conversation by making a point of how there is a difference between this movement and what is has long believed to have been Christianity. And that's something important that people need to stand, because one is not connected to the other, if you want to go with, like I said in the intro, truth and facts.
That is absolutely true, Chris. Christian nationalism is not Christianity. It's not a religion. It's an anti-democratic ideology that exploits religion. Look, this is about politics. It's about power. This is a movement that wants a government-endorsed conservative or reactionary city. They say our laws should be based on the Bible. That is, as they interpret the Bible, the movement disparages the way that most American Christians understand faith. Most American Christians think that faith has to do with loving your neighbor, rather than using religion to dominate other people and impose their religion on other people. So some of the most powerful opposition to Christian nationalism today is coming from faith leaders, people who themselves are Christian, sometimes evangelical. I think of groups like Sojourners or the Baptist Joint Committee, Faithful America, Vote Common Good, New Evangelicals. There are so many others. And the leaders and members of these groups are frankly really upset about how their religion is being exploited for political gain and being distorted in the name of politics. Now, of course, you know, leaders of the Christian nationalist movement in America will cast this as an attack on Christians because they don't want their real motives to be exposed.
The roots of this movement, it's interesting, and if you told someone, they'd say, well, how did we get from there to this? Because it was basically a small number of, albeit well-known, evangelicals looking for a tax break, if you want to get down to it.
Well, it's really interesting. The roots of Christian nationalism go very deep in our country. There have always been strains of reactionary religion fused with identitarian nationalism in America. So, for example, in the 1920s, the far-right populist Gerald K. Smith, who was a white supremacist, started a movement called the America First Party. He was a member of the KKK. He was supportive of Hitler's rise to power, and he was deeply anti-Semitic, and he said America shouldn't intervene. He ran on a presidential ticket in 1948 called the Christian Nationalist Party. And he sort of failed to win his bid and faded into history. But the Christian nationalism in its present form that we see today can be traced to a movement in the late 1970s and early 1980s called the New Right. This was not just an evangelical movement. It drew in ultra-conservative Catholics as well. In addition to people like Paul Weyrich, he was one of the leaders who converted to sort of a more orthodox form of Christianity. You've got folks like Paul Weyrich, Richard Viguerie, Howard Phillips, Phyllis Schlafly. They thought the Republican Party had become too liberal, too soft on communism. They were, as you mentioned earlier, deeply upset about the Internal Revenue Service's threat to revoke tax privilege status for racially segregated schools that were often run by people like Bob Jones, you know, in the South. and called, by the way, you know, segregation God's established order. And they were very concerned about this, but they needed a rallying cry for this movement they called the New Right. And they knew, like, let's stop the tax on segregation. It wasn't really going to be a very appealing message for their movement. So they went down a laundry list of ideas. What could we use? School prayer? Well, that upset the Catholics. They, you know, thought of some other issues. When they got to abortion, it was almost like a light bulb went off. And so that was sort of a hard issue for them at the time, because most Republican Protestants, we have to remember, supported liberalization of abortion laws. Abortion was seen at the time as more of a Catholic issue, but it didn't divide Republicans from Democrats, and it was often couched in terms of a broad range of services to help vulnerable populations that were actually quite progressive in their way. But over time, this movement, you know, these leaders saw the potential of the abortion issue to unite various strands of their movement. So they purged pro-choice voices from the Republican Party. It frankly took a lot of effort. We have to remember at the time the Southern Baptist Convention supported liberalization of abortion laws. Barry Goldwater supported, he's a great conservative hero. He supported liberalization of abortion law. His wife, Peggy, by the way, is like my favorite little factoid. She co-founded Planned Parenthood in Arizona. Imagine a conservative leader's spouse doing that today, working on behalf of reproductive rights. But they were successful eventually in purging those pro-choice voices. So the kind of pro-life religion we see today, it's a modern creation. It was created for political purposes.
Catherine Stewart, her book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, catherinestewart.me, her website. And you are listening to Issues and Ideas. What was one of the many fascinating parts of your reporting and your book is we think of this movement on the high level pedestal platform with the big names, the big money, but this filters through every level of our society, as I had mentioned. And you've gone to some of these more local gatherings, conventions, seminars, workshops, whatever you want to call them. These people have a plan. They're deliberate, they're detailed, and they're willing to spend a lot of money to get what they want.
That's absolutely true. I mean, for people who don't know what it is, really check out something called Project 2025. It's put together in part by the Heritage Foundation, which is one of the most powerful think tanks in this movement. It's a 900-page document that's basically a plan to reshape the government in the event of a Republican victory in the 2024 presidential election. They want to recruit tens of thousands of, I would say, frankly, Trump loyalists to Washington, D.C., replace as many as 50,000 existing federal service workers who they characterize as state. And it really shows the radicalism of this movement. The Heritage Foundation was, for many years, very traditionally right-wing in its pro-business economic ideology and a generally hawkish foreign policy. But this plan, Project 2025, shows us that the old right has essentially left the building. The gatekeepers of the Republican Party have fallen apart. That political party, frankly, is now essentially controlled by the leaders of this movement, sort of religious nationalist movement. And Heritage has a new president now, and under his leadership, the organization has embraced anti-democratic extremism. And you can really see this in that Project 2025.
Which we do have that document over at our website in the downloads page where you can access it. And it'll take a little time, a little study, but believe me, it will be worth your time and your study. And you can find the link to our downloads page at our website. The names are known, well known by many, but there are some that you point out that, as I said, need to be known. Who, talk about R.J. Rushdoony.
Oh, thanks for asking. You know, R.J. Rushdoony was a mid-century theologian. He's considered a godfather of Reconstructionism, a very reactionary sort of religious ideology that essentially says that our laws should be based on the Bible. Some people call it theonomy, a sort of fusion of our laws with theism, of course, as he understands it. But he was very influential. He's not a household name, but he was on the ground level of the formation of the Council for National Policy. It's one of the key networking organizations of this movement. Let's just take a very quick step back. The movement, the strength of this movement is in this dense organizational infrastructure. They have a legal sphere. They have a lot of think tanks. They have a lot of policy groups. But they have these key networking organizations that bring together the leaders of the different organizations and also big money donors. Like if you look at their, they're very secretive, but their some of their membership lists have been leaked. You can find them on a website called Documented, a reporting website, and other places as well. But that's one place that publishes these leaked membership lists and some of their videos. And it really shows a radical plan to make our society on every level. Look, they know very well that a lot of their policies, such as the reproductive stuff, elimination of workforce protections for the workforce, a lot of the elimination of public education, these ideas are radically, the radical ideas are not remotely conservative. They're very unpopular with Americans, but they know if you can take over the courts, you can frankly change the direction of society. And this is something that Rush Denis espoused and endorsed. By the way, he not only sort of proved, quoted these sort of pro-slavery theologians like Dabney and Thornwell, very powerful members of the Southern Presbyterian Church. Not only did he quote them, but he reprinted some of them. He had a publishing house called Chalcedon, and he republished some of them. He essentially, segregation. He spoke about biblical slavery, that was done right according to the Bible. He didn't do it right, but it was done right back then. He also thought, he was very much a gender essentialist, thought that women should be subordinate to men. He thought public education was, quote, training women to be men. I'm like, where'd your kids go to school? How did my kids go through, public schools? And there was nothing like that. No, no gender ideology. They weren't training boys to be girls. It's kind of crazy, the stuff he said. He thought public education was evil and shouldn't exist. His ideas are incredibly radical. When I was researching power worshippers, I kind of fell down a Rush Denis rabbit hole. He was a very prolific writer, and I read about a dozen of his works or more. And the thing about his work is he's not a household name. Again, he's not cited in every church, although he is cited and known among many of the movement leadership. But little bits and pieces of his ideology are there. So he's a fascinating figure for anybody who wants to read more about him. You can pick up Power Worshippers. I have a sort of Rush Denis chapter, and then I show how this very radical ideology, the idea of hierarchies established by God, men over women, white people over black people, etc., no rights for the workforce, how these ideas have spread throughout the movement, even though many of the people espousing them really may not be fully aware of where they're coming from.
We have to wrap up here, but I do want to mention, too, that a lot of what R.J. Rush Denis espoused is being repeated in the here and now by his name escapes me at the moment, but the Republican candidate for governor of North Carolina.
And Mark Robinson.
Thank you.
That guy is wild. I have seen him speak at a number of right-wing conferences. He is as radical as they get.
Whereas I think Donald Trump referred to him as Martin Luther King Jr. on steroids, hardly. But that's that analogy, I'm glad I thought of that too. That analogy is really summing up maybe the secret behind the growth of this movement, because it is through that manipulation, that masking, that is drawing the followers along with the power brokers that has led to its current state and status. Is that the ceiling, as they say? Is there growth still to come? Will there be a counter to it? And how does that counter operate when you'll have a opposition who will basically want to label you as an antichrist if you do? Well, it's through knowledge, it's through facts, it's through history, and it's through the work that Catherine has compiled with her book, The Power of Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, catherinestewart.me. her website, Catherine. Congratulations on presenting the truth, the facts, reality that will give those who are true Christians the power and the empowerment they need to take this to a battle for the protection of their faith, and as well as the non-Christians as well, because that one church is maybe behind, a lot behind the rise of what we've seen with anti-Semitism in this nation as well. But Catherine, your job, your work is very valuable for this battle, and thanks so much for being here today.
Great to talk with you, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.